visa, and about the last month that we were convinced we weren't going to get it and have to look for something else, finally our visa, for no reason we can imagine, did come through, and we, on January 1st of 1986, just a little over a year ago, left with our two daughters, 13 and 15, for at least 5 years in Southern Africa. We'd had a long-standing, about 10-year commitment in advocacy and educational work with National Namibia Concerns and the region of Southern Africa and the struggle for the gospel justice there, specifically in Namibia, and then widened to South Africa. We arrived and found ourselves in placed in a parish of four congregations, about 90 miles in distance. First congregation was in the greater Cape Town area. The second was about 40, and that was sort of the mother congregation, as it were, and had a building. The other three places didn't have any building. The second was a relocation, a forced relocation area, about 40 miles north of the city. And then the two other spots were a small railroad village and a small fishing village. And we spent our time trying to get established, learn the language, which was the language of the people that we served, was Afrikaans. And the people that we were with, we will say they are black. The South African government organizes in the following manner. Racially, you have four classifications. On the top of the pecking order, white, then Asian, Indian, Malaysian descent, then so-called colored, mixed racial tradition, and then fourth, black or African. What the Indians and the so-called coloreds and the Africans are saying is, I am black. And so we say we serve the black congregation. 6 months, 6.5 months after we were there, we had, to make a long story short, we'll be glad to talk about it, but what happened to us and on the events around us, the South African government issued me an expulsion order and forced me to leave the country and physically took me and put me in jail and then put me on a plane, and so I had to leave the country. And Susan and the girls were not included in the order because in South Africa, women and children are considered quote unquote useless appendages. Because the South African government gave me the hospitality of their concrete floor one night, Susan was actually able to find out where I was, what plane I was going to be on. She was able to book the children on that plane, so they actually did board the same plane that I did and fly out of the country at the same time I did, leaving her there to continue ministry. And it was decided after that point that her ministry there then would be one of closure. And so then in September, she returned back to the States. Yes, there were some arrests. No, they were not related to the expulsion order. What we have is an irrational knee-jerk reaction, and like I said, I mean, if that's, we'll be glad to talk about that, but what we think is more the point is that when we were called, we asked ourselves, why should we go? Admittedly, we wanted to go, but then we asked our friends like Sifanya Kamate or Chenawani Ferasani or Abisai Shebali, why should we, another white, you know, man, white woman, another face of the oppressor, come to Southern Africa? And they said, oh, come. You know, it'll be good. We will love you. I mean, that literally, they said, you know, we will love you. Well, they did. I think they knew all along that our reason, that our going was not for them, but was for us. And within the first week that we arrived there, they said to us, now watch and learn and listen and be involved in as much as you can, because your ministry begins when you leave us and go back. And we came to discover, in fact, that that was true. we are changed in many ways that we're only starting to catch on to. Clearly, one of them is the way in which we read the Bible. And did I leave stuff out?
No, that'll pass.
And so we'd like to show you some images and lead into some perspectives that we gained about ourselves and our world through seeing and experiencing their part of the world, and then open that up for general conversation and discussion. And as we said, we'll be glad to be around at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon or more if that's a good idea. So.
Please feel free to move around so that you can see the screen. I don't know how this will work. This will be maybe 15, maybe 20 minutes of telling some stories and have some images to go along with them on the screen. Then we'd like to converge again around in a circle so we can have some discussion and conversation. So I guess if someone knows where the lights are in here. And I think I will... I think maybe I should just stand back here and talk since I can't stand in the front. Can everyone hear if I stand back here?
That's okay. Long enough.
All right.
Did she raise it?
Well, there are some slide things that go vertically, that go up, so we do that as a happy medium. The countries in South Africa and Namibia are really a beautiful land. And many beautiful people live there. This is Mrs. Sorote, who works with these very young children in what is called a creche in South Africa. We would call it daycare here. The people live in rural areas and in cities. Some of the places look a lot like the United States. Some look very different. Frida Shibute and her mother-in-law in the north of Namibia. Some friends in our living room on the birthday of Nelson Mandela.
Slow down.
I'm just going to go quickly and then we'll tell some stories. That's one of the resettlement areas out there in the middle of the desert. Some of the prime land like that's given to Africans like we give to Native Americans in this country. Daughters and nieces of Zephania Kameta, who has been to Holden. He's a bishop of the Lutheran Church in Namibia. Ben Sifa, Lutheran pastor in Alexandra Township of Johannesburg. Two high school girls in the Lutheran Church in Alexandra who would like to write to some girls or guys in the United States, share experiences. The Shea-Avali family in Namibia. These are near where we lived in Cape Town, the Cape of Good Hope, where the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean come together, Table Mountain, all these classic, beautiful scenes. This is our only tourist picture. Some of you may know Joyce and Tom Soldner, who are from Port Townsend, who also serve in South Africa in Johannesburg. And beautiful Cape Town, where we lived. But as you know, the countries of South Africa and Namibia also have a dark side, an ugly side, which is called apartheid, meaning literally separateness in Afrikaans. From the moment of your birth till the moment of your death, you are classified by the color of your skin and everything about your life is determined. People are separated from each other and they are separated from the wealth of their own land, the indigenous people. And so the first day we arrived in Cape Town, we saw right there when we got off the train, a place called District 6, that bare area with a few buildings in the middle, right next to downtown. In the early 60s, it was decided by the government that this land was too good of a piece of land. And so they literally kicked everyone off it that was living there because they were people of color and relocated them in many different locations. And but they left the churches there in the middle of that space because South Africa is a so-called Christian country. And they wouldn't tear down the churches and the mosques. And so we begin a long set of contradictions that we will be talking about. Cape Town Our parishes were in Greater Cape Town and stretched up to Atlantis, up in the north, 40 miles north of Cape Town, where some of these people that lived in District 6 were relocated, and then all the way up to Friedenberg and Saldana. Atlantis is just a place where these buildings, these are two family dwelling houses and flats, and the people have been relocated there, as happens all over South Africa, with no job. They had to leave their jobs. These places were built for industry that never came, and so it's a very depressed area. The separation is not only petty apartheid stuff like toilets for whites and toilets for blacks and so forth and so on, but it's much more basic than that. It is also separation from the very wealth of their land and the land itself. This is a ruins of a very early gold miners' hostel in Johannesburg, where the gold was mined by black people, the gold that made South Africa rich. And these are the places where the men slept that mined the gold. They each had a little cubby hole like this. And so the story goes. But today, as 100 years ago, the story has continued on with colonialization, neo-colonialization, raping the land and taking it away from the people. And one of the things that makes this different, I think, that we feel very strongly about, than other places in the world where there is also oppression and all sorts of manners of terrible things going on, is that in South Africa, it is done by a so-called Christian government, a so-called democracy. It is done in the name of God. So this is the Mother Church, of the Dutch, the Mother Congregation of the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa. And just to tell you a tiny part of the story of how apartheid is built by people who believe they find proof for it in the Bible. Here is a fresco that talks about an important date for Afrikaners, December 16, 1836. When, like in our own country, we were moving inward with wagon trains and meeting the indigenous people, so they were in South Africa as well. And on December 16th, they prayed to God because the next day they were going to meet thousands of Zulu-speaking people. And they prayed that God would give them the victory over those people, and that they made a covenant. And they said, God, if you give us the victory, then we'll know that you have given us this land as a gift to us, to do with as we will, and to do with the people in the land as we will. And so the next day, the Battle of Blood River, where the white Afrikaners had the guns and the Zulu-speaking people had swords and spears, they were all slaughtered. And to this day, December 16th is a national holiday and is celebrated as one of the founding times of South Africa. This theology and politics of separation is actually written in law, and it's written on a map. It's mapped out. So you have these dark, this is the country of South Africa on the bottom tip of Africa. The colored in areas are the so-called homelands that you've probably heard a lot of. Some of them are claimed to be independent countries. And so you have, Greg, could you point out Boko Botswana?
This is my favorite part.
He gets to point. Well, don't forget that other important piece down there. It's Bantu. That is one independent country. Yeah, right. That, you know, and so the people are who are Sotho speaking, many of them are, it says on their pass that they must live in these God-forsaken looking places. And so the Xhosa-speaking people must live in the pink area down on the coast and the red area. And the Zulu-speaking people live in KwaZulu in the green island kind of area on the coast. And so on and so on. And then the red lines represent where people have been moved hundreds and hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles from where they were born into one of these homelands and told them that this is your homeland, this is where you belong, this is where you must stay. So here we have a modern day hostel, not so much different from the one I showed you before, where this man lives with his little corner for 11 and a half months of the year with one locker and one bed. He lives in a huge hostel like this one. This one happens to be in Windhoek, Namibia. He's watched like cattle going in and out of these gates day and night, locked in at night, kept track of. He has to look through the window out at the world through barbed wire. And he's away from his family, who are back in, for instance, Cape Town, down right there where we live. The people who got passes to live and work in Cape Town, their wives and families and elderly live 500 miles away as this guy, and trans guy. And you would only see your family for 2 weeks out of every year, if you were lucky. Well, obviously this is a lousy way to live. It's one of the ways that South Africa does divide and conquer, divide and rule very, very well. And people like Tom Zodwa, this woman with her four children, said, "Hell no, we won't go," kind of thing. And they said, "No, we're going to come and we're going to live with, I'm going to come and live with my husband in Cape Town and we're going to just survive the best we can." So she and, when we arrived in Cape Town, there were 100,000 people living in Crossroads, which is where Tom Zodwa lives with her family. They have built houses and shacks out of anything they can find, cardboard, corrugated iron, plastic, anything they can find. And they live together here with no sewers, just a couple of water taps and so on and so forth. And it's, you can see how close together they live. It's very difficult for the government to come in and control them. So one of the horrors that you may have seen this last year on television and in the papers before the new press clampdown was that the government on May 18th, on Pentecost, moved in and burned down Crossroads.
The tree.
The row of trees in the back there, just note that. You can see in this picture how close all the buildings are together. Now, when the burning first started, the government was saying in the press that this was one of those black-on-black tribal fights. That sometimes you hear that kind of black-on-black violence term used in the press. And the churches, however, were hearing a different story. And so the Council of Churches in Cape Town did an SOS call to all clergy to come to Crossroads and to listen to the stories of the people, which we did. We came and we listened, and to see with our own eyes what was really happening. And what we saw was that this was not some tribal conflict, but this was a carefully orchestrated act of state terrorism that was done by the police and the army. 40,000 people were burned out of their homes within 1 week, while the army watched and helped hand out the weapons and in all sorts of ways assisted. They had a coerced group of people called vigilantes to do the work for them and with them. One of the other things we did that week was to provide a buffer zone for people like the people on the left there who were trying to save their parts of their houses. When they would go in and try to save so that they could rebuild, the vigilantes, on the group on the left there with the white scarves around their necks, would come in and keep them from doing it while the army on the right there just watches. So we provided a buffer zone so people could come in and take out some of the things that they could save. That's the infamous Casper of the South African Defense Force that was is an armored troop carrier that can go over landmines that are an everyday occurrence everywhere in South Africa. Some people were able to save a few things, but most people lost everything. This guy was sitting on the rest of his family's belongings, and I asked him if I could take his picture, at which time he flashed that tiny hopeful smile and raised his fist, which in South Africa is to say, "I have not given up hope. We will be free someday." And now you can see that line of trees in the back. After 1 week, the government came in and bulldozed down the whole thing that had been burned. And the next week, they moved on to the next squatter camp with 40,000 more people, and the same thing happened again. And this time we were there from the beginning. And we, I went in with some medical people and clergy trying to find the, trying to assist in ways that we could, and we saw that the police were tear gassing people who were trying to save things from their houses. They were handing out weapons. They were transporting the viduka, the vigilantes, around from place to place. They were actually torching houses themselves from their caspers. and they were doing all manner of things that you may have heard or read about. Anything that was alleged, I or read or some of our groups saw. And what is so true in South Africa is that they do not want this word to get out of the country. And so as here, as I was leaving and watching down in the middle of that street, the Casper with the Biduka around and their torching houses, we were there with a BBC television crew, and I'm taking this picture over this guy's shoulder. You can see his beard on the right-hand corner. Of course they don't want pictures to get out. So the Casper came down and tear gassed us. And this squatter camp, which is called KTC today, it's also been bulldozed down, but you'll notice in the middle, there's a church. Because this is a Christian country, so-called. And, of course, they wouldn't bulldoze down the churches. Now, they wanted the people to move many miles out farther to a planned community called Khayelitsha. And the people don't want to move. It's just a big sand dune. And here they have built gravel roads and mapped out the whole thing with small sites with an outhouse. You can see that row of outhouses down the street, giving each person a site that they must rent in order to build something on, so that they can get in there with the Caspers and control what's going on day and night. They also have huge floodlights that light up the place all night long. This is someone trying to grow a garden in the sand. Churches Urban Planning Commission. The people at that work, this is the staff of that building, and as I look at their, I mean, of that organization, as I look at their faces, I know that about half of these people in the last few months have been in detention because of working to meet people's needs with the church. Charles Martin, Methodist pastor, was in detention for 2 months during the last state of emergency, part of the staff of this building. And part of the work that this group does is work with the families of Section 29 detainees. This is Debbie Fonda Rirda, whose husband is a high school teacher and who was arrested in February just after we arrived with several other people who are being tried for treason right now. And he was held for all those months under a section called 29, which means indefinite interrogation, no contact with family, with lawyer, with pastor. They don't have to tell you where the person is being held or anything, just one of the many horrific laws that South Africa has. And so we went with these women to bring things every Monday morning to the headquarters of the security police, which is kind of like the Nazi SS. So the only contact they had with their husbands, they couldn't see them, they could just bring them things. Candlelight service with the children of the Section 29 detainees who haven't seen their parents, haven't seen their fathers. One of the detainees in this group gave birth to a baby while she was in detention. School children in South Africa are another of a group of people who are faithfully struggling and who are bearing the cost of that struggle very deeply. There are children, these children's ages, in prison right now in South Africa. 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds on up are being held in prison incommunicado from their parents. People like Anthony, who many nights knocked on our door and had to hide from the police because of his participation in student groups in his high school. People like Edwin on the left and George on the right, who have also been in detention, they are the chairman of Inter-Christian Youth in Cape Town. Just ordinary folks. These are Christian youth in South Africa, and this group was a group at the National Lutheran Youth Convention, and the song that they were singing when I took this picture was, the chorus is freedom and hope, freedom and peace. You cannot destroy our dream, over and over again. Sekopi Malefo, who is a youth director in the Lutheran Church, and the police are trying a new strategy with Sekopi. They are spreading the word around that he is a collaborator with the police in hopes that his own people will do something to him because they haven't been able to get him. Another place where the faithful struggle is going on is in the neighboring country of Namibia, which is also ruled by South Africa with the same apartheid. It is the most Lutheran country in the world, except the Scandinavian and German countries where you're kind of born into the church. There are more people in Namibia who are Lutheran by choice than anywhere else. And in this place, people live in these so-called homelands in buildings like this. This is someone's home. Zephania Kameta, one of the bishops of the Lutheran Church there, who has been to Holden. We were able to spend a week in the north with where the war zone is. And this picture, although it's a nice sunset, that's not why the picture is taken. It's taken to remind me of the fact that what's true in the north is that, and has been for many, many years, is that there is a dusk to dawn curfew there. And if you're caught outside after dark, you're shot. While we were there, planes circled overhead with searchlights all night long to see if they could find somebody moving to shoot at. This, if any of you have seen Cry for Freedom, this is the ruins of the bombed out Lutheran printing press, the only free press in the north which has been bombed twice. The whole north is just one militarized bunker after another when you go along the road like this. The Lutheran Hospital in the north, when we visited there, there was a young 13-year-old who had been the day before had been held over an open fire and barbecued by the South African police. This is the kind of stuff that these people go through day in and day out. And they don't give up and they still hope. Frida and Usko Shibute, maybe some of you might have met them when they studied at Luther College in the United States. They're back in Namibia now, teaching and nursing. Frida has to walk to work at his clinic every day while the South African Defense Force camps eating their breakfast under these trees. One night happened to be the 4th of July. We were not able to go to Frida and Usko's house because of a roadblock, and we couldn't get through, so we had to stay in the guest house. Took a picture out through these closed doors. And for us, it was a very painful and meaningful night being in the north of Namibia on the 4th of July, on the day when, as Americans, we should be remembering and celebrating that we stand for freedom and peace and justice in the world. And here we were in a country where the United States is standing in their way. On our Independence Day, we were in a country where, because of the United States, this country is not free. And so we wrote letters to President Reagan and drank toast to Namibia's freedom and prayed prayers in our evening prayers. Praying prayers in South Africa and Namibia is a very dangerous thing, just to pray. So perhaps you at St. Olaf and here at Holden and other places on June 16th this year gathered with Christians around the world to pray for the end to unjust rule. It was the 10th anniversary of the massacre of children at Soweto.
But what happens in South Africa and Namibia is that sometimes when you do that, you are arrested. And so here at St. Nicholas Episcopal Church, Rez, with 250 other people, were arrested on this day during a prayer service. The police came in and just arrested the whole entire church. Men, women, children, pastors took them all off to prison. For doing this, for praying the Lord's Prayer. Let now your kingdom come, let now your will be done. Remove the tyranny, establish just rule. Some of those people were held as long as 4 weeks under the state of emergency without being charged with anything. Currently now in South Africa, you can be held 180 days without being charged, with no access to anyone. And so at this prayer service as well, where I attended after the rest of the family had left, about 500 people had gathered to pray. And as we were lighting candles and praying at the end of the service for the release of the detainees, of the people in prison and for their families, the police marched in through the back. And they came up to the front and where Alan Buzak was reading the service and started and told him to stop, and he would not, and he kept on, and everyone kept on praying and singing, and they started ripping out the microphone system and hassling and intimidating everyone, and announced that we were all under arrest. And for the next 2 hours, it was an amazing experience to be there, to see the people continuing with their praying and singing. And so this is one of the people that were there, Zinzi. She hasn't been able to live with her mother for over a year because her mother, June, the woman in the middle here, was arrested a year ago and tortured by the security police, and she is bravely pushing assault charges against them, and her life, they say if they catch her again, they will kill her this time. And so she's been in hiding ever since and has not been able to live with her daughter. She came to pray that day, as did many others in her situation, knowing that they might be risking their lives. The police guard at the door, and they come in and they videotape. They came in and videotaped everyone that was there to have our faces on record. But they, on this particular occasion, they let everyone go and just tear gassed at the end. Now we tell you some of these stories to say that we firmly believe that what's happening in South Africa is not just another oppression, not just another place in the world where there are political and social problems, but it is a very particular situation in which it's not just political or social, but it is a religious problem in South Africa. Because the line at the top there is how the South African Constitution begins. In humble submission to Almighty God, And he goes on to say, who has brought us to this place and given us this land and protected us from our enemies, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then it spells out all the legalized racism that is apartheid. And that is the basis upon which this country operates. And so many Christians in South Africa are asking the question that this poster asks. Is the state in South Africa God's good servant that is talked about in Romans 13? Or has it in fact become another kind of government that's talked about in Revelation 13, one that sometimes we forget about, that's also in the Bible, the beast uttering arrogant and blasphemous words? And many people in the church are saying now that for the church in South Africa and the church around the world, it's now a Kairos moment, a moment of truth, a moment of decision, a moment, a pregnant moment, when for the sake of the gospel, the church must change sides and clearly speak and act on behalf of the gospel. This banner hangs in the lobby of Kotso House, which means peace, where the South Africa Council of Churches is housed in Johannesburg. Red, can you get to the book? It's over.
Where?
It's where we're going to stand originally, but it's
over. Okay. Got it.
Thank you. And can you see the book?
Now I can.
Okay.
A reading from a book written by Sophania Kameta entitled Why, O Lord. There are about six copies left in the bookstore I saw today. Psalm 27 is paraphrased this way. The Lord is my light and my liberation. I will fear no so-called world powers. The Lord protects me from all danger. I will never be afraid. When their security forces attack me and try to kill me, they stumble and fail. Even though the whole imperialist army surrounds me, I will not be afraid. I will trust in God, my liberator. I have asked the Lord for one thing only do I want, to be God's instrument in the struggle for liberation and to be driven by God's love. In times of war, God will shelter me and keep me safe in loving hands and make me secure on a high rock. So I will triumph over the oppressive regime. With shouts of joy, I will give my life as a sacrifice in your service, and I will praise and sing freedom songs to my Lord. Hear me, Lord, when I call to you. Be merciful and answer me. When you said, come and be my servant, I answered, I will come, Lord. Do not hide yourself from me. Do not be angry with me. Do not turn your servant away. You have been my help. Do not leave me. Do not abandon me, O God, my liberator. My father and mother may abandon me, but the Lord will be with me in this present situation and forever. Teach me, Lord, what you want me to do, and lead me along in this difficult situation. Do not abandon me to the worshippers of apartheid and their collaborators who attack me with lies and threats. I know I will live to see in this present life the Lord's victory over the enemies of the oppressed people in Southern Africa. Trust in the Lord. Have faith. Do not despair. Trust in the Lord.
It was this kind of hope and this kind of trust and this kind of faithful acting and living that was a great witness to us and taught us that being in mission is way more learning from the people that you are with than it is bringing anything to them at all. And with that, we could have the lights. And we hope that maybe some of these pictures and stories will elicit some things that you'd like to talk about now for a while. If you need to be on your way, please feel free to do that too. Why don't we just gather ourselves around it?
If for the rest of the time we can be outrageously biased and we think, maybe not altogether unobjective. I think we can bring what some people call objectivity to bear, but we also promise to be as outrageously biased as we can. We think the gospel demands it. Can we just circle around? And for those who need to go, thanks very much.
The last week that I was in South Africa, someone came and brought a gift to me, and she said, "Do you know that when in the newspapers they say that we weren't shooting live ammunition at those kids the other night, we were only shooting rubber bullets?" Have you ever heard those kind of comments from the South African police? Well, she said, "Last night they were shooting at the children in our street, and I picked this up and brought it to you because I want you to show the American people what they shoot at our kids. This is a rubber bullet. That thing is shot at 150 miles out of a gun, and if it hits you in the head, it can kill you, especially if you're 7 years old or four or three. It breaks bones, and it screws up your insides if it hits you in a vital organ." So that's a show and tell you can pass around while we're having
we would like it back.
Conversation. Yes, it's our best show and tell. Questions, comments?
Did you come into any contact with an Afrikaner post-contact?
Yeah.
Limited. We spent most of our time in the black community. But yes, we had to live in the white community, and our daughters were tutored in the Afrikaans language by an Afrikaner who was... husband happened to be a member of the army, the SADF.
You didn't have any choice about things like that, where you lived?
We did not have any choice. By law, you're required to live in a segregated area.
Unfortunately, just as we were leaving, we were beginning a special petition to be able to move into the community where we worked, which they do give permission for sometimes, especially like for clergy, to live outside the group area that you're legally supposed to live in, but we hadn't gotten that far yet. So our kids went to white English-speaking schools and had quite a schizophrenic existence, going to school in that situation during the day, and then in the evening, on Sundays and other occasions, being in our home and in the parish with all sorts of other kinds of people, and having that double kind of existence.
Maybe you can appreciate what it was like for them. They thought going to school was just fine, and they were enjoying their, comfortable upper middle class environment. All white people enjoy, most white people enjoy very comfortable standard of living. And until after Crossroads, and they spent time there, especially at the Red Cross Relief Center. And then that happened to be a holiday time, and then they were going to go back to school, and they said, but it won't make any sense. Nobody will understand. School doesn't make any sense in this place, because these kids go on as if nothing has happened, and they won't even talk to us. And they were beginning to experience that conflict within themselves, and delightfully enough for our point of view, very enculturated, white, middle-class American girls were saying they'd rather spend their time with the people in the black community who seemed to be living life in a way that made more sense to them. Mm-hmm.
Susan, you mentioned some tear gas at the end when you were in a Crossroads situation, but were you free to just wander around there during this time taking pictures? How did they happen to permit that you could be there during this time?
Well, it goes up and down on that, and it depends on where you are. Now, since June, I couldn't do that. I probably couldn't do that. I also had my film taken away a couple of times. But now it's illegal for a journalist or someone taking pictures
to be, even to be within sight of something that is deemed an unrest situation. So if something happens right here, and you happen to be a journalist, you have to take yourself away even from it, or you could be arrested. Not only can you not take pictures, you can't even see it happening, and you certainly can't report on it. So, and for instance, we got our, this is the closest thing to an alternative newspaper, comes out weekly, called the Weekly Mail. We got it in the mail just before we left yesterday. And this is the advertisement for the Release Mandela campaign this week. Because it was censored. But there's now a big fight going on in the government because now in some places they have moved, they have said it's illegal to print blank spaces in newspapers even.
They're trying to research the law to figure out how this is a breaking of the banning order.
Oh, sorry, sure.
And then,
oftentimes the way they, like when the state of emergency started, they printed blank spaces, or they would print articles that had a lot of the names crossed out, stuff like that, and then they would say, we would like to print this, but under the state of emergency regulations, we cannot tell about these events. And then they made that illegal, and they said, you can't do that. And so now they're going to just printing blank spaces, so at least people will be reminded that there are things going on, but they can't read about them. Sometimes we can find out about it here before people in South Africa find out about it. That's how bad the disinformation and the banning is there.
We happen to get some of those pictures from Crossroads for two reasons. One, because the British ambassador came through the area. And so for a period of about an hour or two, there was confusion, and they didn't stop anybody from doing anything.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we just went click, 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 click. And then the second reason was because we arrived one morning on the scene with some African friends and walked into the burning and were not stopped. I mean, no one, they didn't stop us. But 15 minutes after the picture that Susan took over the, where you saw the beard, a television camera crewman was killed.
That,
and we, I mean, I was one of the last people to speak to that guy. His face is still in my mind. He said, where is the rest of my team? I was in the car with another newspaper guy, and we said, oh, I think he's down that way. And he never came back. So it is dangerous.
We had one of those quick shoot cameras, point and shoot focus, that I could put in my pocket, a large pocket, and just go like this. That's how I took a lot of pictures.
Yeah. Where are the English-speaking churches trying to do? What can they do? And is there an also very movement at all about churches who may have a long time?
That's a good question. Have we got a long time to talk about? But how many of you have perhaps heard of the Kairos document? It's a document that is about a year old now, and written by a growing segment of the church in South Africa, which would be English-speaking segment of the church, I suppose. But it has three sections, one critiquing each of those groups that you just mentioned. The first section is called State Theology, and it addresses this kind of thing that we experience in this country as well, where our president gives us that blessing at the end of all of his speeches, and we blur the difference between religion and state and politics and all of that. And that's what the Afrikaners and the Afrikaans-speaking churches represent. Then the next section is called Church Theology, in which they are equally critical of the white English-speaking churches, which are more liberal, really, and they have made statements like John DeGruchy's book called Apartheid is a Heresy, and they've said apartheid is wrong, we've got to change it, and they've made all these good statements. They haven't done a whole lot. That's about as far as it's gone statements. And like many of us good liberals here in the United States, we talk a good line, but if we need to act where it's going to cost us anything, where are we all, really, you know? So it does a critique of that, and then it moves on to what they call prophetic theology, which is the costly actions and speaking
which this particular segment of the church is challenging the church in South Africa and around the world to move to that section. And it would be quite a lot of people in the South African Council of Churches and those kind of folks who that's where they are at this point in time.
So if you're a little confused by our answer, you're catching on.
Sorry, yeah, there's not one line in the church there.
But clearly the indigenous peoples, the African peoples, are in writing this document together with some people of Afrikaner and British descent are trying to grasp hold of who they are as God's people and invite the rest of us to see and do the same in a more faithful way. And it's their intention for this to be the Barman Declaration of South Africa, sort of the notion that they've come from.
Would you say that most of the white English speakers, English-speaking Christians in South Africa, are liberals, and then that has sort of a sense that there's something wrong with this, but a kind of inability to really translate that into any action?
Well, tell them about...
I wouldn't put most people in that category, but I would tell you this short story as a way of answering. About three blocks from where we lived in the white English-speaking church that's considered to be the most liberal one in Cape Town, and it's the church that John DiGrucci goes to and his family go to. And they're considered to be, you know, progressive even, not only liberal but progressive. Must have been 2 years ago now, one of the issues in Cape Town that some people felt they could attack and act on was segregated theaters. So a group of people in this church challenged the church to have all of us take that very seriously and not attend any movie theater that had a racial admittance policy. And they voted that through, that that would be a place where they could stand, one place where they could begin to act, you know? So as a high school kid, you would not go, even if it was your favorite movie, it was only at that one theater, you wouldn't go to it. And that small act was too costly for a large group of that church who split off and left the church.
Over half
the church left over that issue. And we can all sit here very sort of smugly and go, oh, where are they at, you know? But it's hard to imagine the incredible propaganda of and fear campaign that has been going on there for years, where you are afraid of what's going to happen, even if there's nothing to be afraid of if majority rule comes. That you are just scared to death, or you are literally building walls around your house, so that in our neighborhood there were high walls around most people's houses where you had to talk in an intercom just to get into the door of the gate to get eventually to the front door, because people are so afraid, thereby not asking.
Apartheid has been effective in many ways, divide and rule, creating intimidation, creates that fear and separation, that isolation, fosters that all the more, and so it spirals. Yeah, back here.
How do you see it with the U.S. both government and industry's relationship to what's going on there? Is it more the same, worse?
Well, I one of the things that we need to say is we've been students around the issues in Southern Africa for about 10 years. But we were only there for 6 months, and we were there primarily in Cape Town. So we are not asking you to accept what we say as gospel, as final word, or as, you know, authoritative. But we did have some experience.
Can you pass us the book that's right there?
Just throw it.
That's fine. There was a group that was there during the same, happened to be there during the same 6 months that Red was there, called the Commonwealth Group, that some of you may have read about their reports in the paper, Eminent Persons Group, representing the former British Empire countries, of which South Africa was one of, is now the British Commonwealth. They went on a fact-finding tour of a very high degree in which they talked to all of the liberation group people inside and outside the country, in prisons, all levels of government, everybody, churches, the whole bit. And this is a very fine book that we would highly recommend, which I thought was going to be boring when I first, you know, that a report is usually very boring, but it makes its point very well. Why don't you read a couple of this? And
the government of South Africa, the Commonwealth Group has opened and explored the path to change. The government of South Africa refuses to take it. Indeed, it would seem to seal it off. Sanctions and peace for South Africa have now become one and the same. And the absence of economic sanctions, that is pressure on the government, will only help the government in its belief that it can defer change, the absence of that pressure. And then that's what they say in one of their prefaces, their foreword. Part of their conclusions, they say, it is not sanctions which will destroy the country, but the persistence of apartheid and the government's failure to engage in fundamental political reform. And they also say that South African blacks now have a confidence not merely in the justice of their cause, but in the inevitability of their cause. Unlike earlier periods, they now have their convictions are matched by their readiness to die for their convictions. They will therefore sustain their struggle at whatever the cost. Specifically in relationship to business, we hear all the time about how our participation in South African propaganda is that, you know, we can't pull out because, my goodness, we're hurting the very people we intend to help. It's very interesting that Control Data, a company that some Lutherans are aware of, employed at one point 16 blacks. I mean, that their big effort to be there, to make this big change. General Motors Corporation employed all of 2,000 people at one point, only 60 of whom were black. And none of them were in high managerial positions. So
24 million blacks in the country.
So what we're saying is that not only are the arguments erroneous because there simply aren't sufficient numbers to make the arguments sustainable, but they're erroneous because, in fact, American corporate presence is there for a corporate profit. And our presence there continues to create more division within the black community by allowing, you know, I mean, it would be as if in this circle, Susan and I were able to provide adequately for our family. We were able to improve our home, build on an extra room or two in this very same community where you lived, where you didn't have enough food, where you had where your homes were poorly kept, and where your job security was in tough shape. And you know what? We don't want our kids to play with you. And we don't want our kids to talk with your kids about what the future of the country's about, because we have something to lose.
And even if we do have a better house, our kids still have to go to the same crummy school. Or perhaps if there's someone working in the mines, he still has to live, and he's getting a salary from some American company, he still has to live 11 and a half months of the year away from his family. So some of these cosmetic little things that people are getting out of jobs don't even begin to touch the reality of the whole system.
There you go again, just being biased as all get out. Well, it's interesting to note that this report does not contradict one thing that we say. And these folks are people like Lord Barber, who is chairman of the Standard Bank, which controls one-third of the financial industry in South Africa and has everything to lose if it goes down the tubes. And he is among those people who says sanctions are absolutely necessary for the survival of that country. And it's interesting that the five-point agenda that they put forward as the agenda for change is almost identical to the agenda, and it's nonviolent, it is negotiated, and it's a politically negotiated settlement. And it is not a military solution. Almost the identical agenda that the ANC has always been asking for. You know, that communist terrorist organization that won't do anything except blow up babies. And you see the way the game works?
I have two questions. They're both centered on the divestiture issue. You talked about two companies who proportionally employ very few blacks. Could you give some kind of an average of American corporations of how many blacks proportionately they employ?
General Motors is the second largest employer, only to Mobile. I mean, what we're saying is that the total percentages are infinitesimally small.
The second question is related. Is there any, I know it's a complex issue, in your mind, is there any good argument that is for non-divestiture?
No.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, now, of course, for the last couple of months, you've been reading about Coca-Cola's pulling out, GM's pulling out, IBM's pulling out. You know what that means? That means that that America, IBM America, will not be selling computers in South Africa anymore. But there is a South African franchise of IBM, and although IBM American, whatever it's called, is the American IBM, by law, could not sell to the South African police, military, or government. Now there's no law that keeps IBM South Africa from selling any computer technology or computers to anyone. And IBM America will still be providing all the technology, the parts, and the whole bit, and they're making a lot more money this way than they are on these businesses, which inside the country are losing money. Because when before we came, the rand, which was the dollar in South Africa, was worth $1.25 about a month, August, a year and a half ago. When we got there, it was worth 38 cents in January a year ago, and now it's worth 45 cents. So the country really is in bad shape financially, and these companies are leaving because it's bad business for them to be there, and because people like us have been giving them a lot of grief on this side with the divestment campaign, and so they figured out a way to make just as much money or more and look good at the same time.
But now you heard what she said, then you'd say, but maybe didn't Susan just use an argument to stay there? Because if you pull out, then you let the companies sell entirely. And that is one of the trade-offs. But you see, here's the issue for us. We think that we do not have the right to decide for them. That is one of the fundamental sins of arrogance that we think we need to confess and seek to change, to have conversion about. And South African people involved with the struggle of liberation have said, you're not helping. And so what we're saying is we need to take our cues from them. And so that's one piece. The second piece would be that economic language of this business that the companies are now doing is simply joint ventures, which is a kind of thing that's being done all the time. And it means that you still have more than just your foot in the door, and you have your hand in the pocket, but you don't have the liability.
The way to close off this one now is to ban all exports to South Africa. So that IBM can't export its parts either, that kind of thing.
In other words, legislative action would be the move in that direction.
It's been about an hour, so I think what we'll do is close by showing a couple of show and tells for you, so that some of you would like to get to bed or take a sauna or whatever can do that. But we'll be happy to stay around longer if people would like to stay and talk some more.
I want to read this poem.
You do?
I do.
All right.
In response to we think that one of the things that we're not welcome to do is that all this crap about we're going to go find out and decide. We have a responsibility to relate and try to trust our brothers and sisters in Southern Africa. white man, we shall have our land, which you, we so foolishly allowed you to take, turning us into strangers in places we roamed before you came. You have placed us in desert land with thorny trees, white man, while your cattle grow.